Hello and welcome to another of my comedian's interviews for my blog, A Rich Comic Life. My name is Richard Gill and my blog details my experiences of watching over 750 comedians and counting over the last 45 years. My guest tonight is a fantastic comedy impersonator, the wonderful Mr. Luke Kempner. Yes! Yes! Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm very well, man. Very nice to see you.
Very nice to see you. Thank you so much for doing this.
My absolute pleasure.
That's very kind of you. We're going to spend, it's going to be about an hour. And we're going to just explore your wonderful comedy career.
It'd be fun to chat through it.
Well, let's begin. So we'll go way back to the start. So I believe you started your career in musical theatre.
Yeah, that's true.
What made you become a comedy impersonator?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you say, like, I started in musical theatre. I left drama school when I was 21, just 21, and I was in shows like Les Mis and Avenue Q and South Pacific, and I did that for about 4 years, but I'd always done impressions from when I was at drama school, and even from when I was at school, really, but at drama school, I used to do impressions of all the teachers. And I would always do, at the end of the year, we'd do a sort of Christmas concert.
Yeah.
And I would do a set of about 8 minutes, which seems mad to me now that it was that long, but it used to be about 8 minutes. And I remember the first one I did was a sort of, it was all the teachers were planning their nativity play.
Right.
And I played all the different teachers. And it very much in the same style that I do now, jumping from character to character, all the different voices and the gags sort of intertwined. And that's how I started. And for me, that was the best feeling I ever got compared to being in a musical or being in a play or anything like that. It was being on stage, performing jokes I'd written and performing impressions that I'd come up with.
Yeah.
And so, and I remember teachers and stuff, people sort of giving me advice of like, oh, you must use this talent and that sort of thing. And that was a very accurate impression, if you know. And I remember sort of I didn't know about comedy clubs because drama school, you don't have that same sort of link like you would at university where it would be, oh, the Chortle Student Awards, or I just didn't know about anything like that. So then my plan was always just go into musical theatre, which I did, and it was great, and had some incredible experiences being in the shows that I mentioned.
Yeah.
And then I'd done the same sort of thing when I was on tour in these shows, doing impressions of cast members and winding up, you know, coming over the tannoy and getting people to come down to warm up, doing impressions of our company manager, etc. But even at one point, we had a company manager who had a parrot, right? A parrot called Tyrone, and I remember getting on the tannoy and going, hello, it's me, Megan here. I'm here with Tyrone. Stop it, Tyrone. Everybody come downstairs. The warm-up's going to start. And all this sort of thing. And like, I used to get so tired out of it. So then, you know, when it got to the end of sort of 2011, and I was only like 24.
Right.
And then I decided, a friend of mine sort of said to me, said, look, there's this guy that he'd seen a video of Terry Minor doing some impressions on YouTube. And Terry's just sort of sat in his office chair just going, I'm going to do some impressions. And then he does the impression. And I loved it. And my mate was like, oh man, it's so good, you should do that. And I was sort of like, well, I don't want to do this kind of like, oh, here's me doing Homer Simpson. Oh, here's me doing this. So I was like, I sort of always wanted it to do it in the way I'd done it, with this sort of character to character.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is where the video downstairs at Downton sort of came from. Because originally I did some interviews.
I did one as Andy Murray where my friend interviewed me. And in the video, I'm really drunk, actually. I'm just sort of, and I did this whole sort of scenario about how he'd been taught how to cry.
Then I did a whole Tom Daley one where Tom was trying to get his medal changed from a bronze medal into a gold. Something like that. And then this downstairs down, because I was like, look, I think what I can do is do lots of impressions without even sort of any cuts or anything. It just going from everything from Mr. Carson to Mrs. Pat or to me, Mrs. Pat. Thank you. And you know, Lord Grantham and Maggie Smith. And I was like, I'm going to do 12 impressions in one video. So I wrote it, and my mate helped me edit it, and then he filmed it and put it out there. And then this was in 2012. And then Stephen Fry got sent the video by an actor friend of mine. And then he tweeted about it in the days when Stephen Fry was Twitter.
Yeah.
And he tweeted about it saying, oh, a splendid display of Downtonry. I remember it well, because it was on every poster I've ever
done. Brilliant.
And then I went from that to doing that. I wrote a show.
I first came across you on the video, I thought, who is this bloke? He's impersonating every one of these characters, and they were so accurate. And I was delighted for you when you you turned it into a show, so a bigger audience could see, an even bigger audience could see, and of course live adds the extra element to it as well.
Well, it's sort of preposterous, really, because, you know, I knew about Edinburgh. I'd done Edinburgh when in 2008 I've been in a musical in 2008 called Departure Lounge.
Right.
So I'd done Edinburgh, but I didn't know the comedy scene or anything. Knew it was a festival. So I went up there. James Seabright, the producer, took me up there. I played a 49-seater venue, and I just sort of had no idea. I'd never done any gigs or anything. I'd been in Les Mis, so I'd done Les Mis in front of thousands of people,
but
I'd never done, you know, a solo one-man show. But I've always had this sort of this rip-roaring confidence in my performance skills. Not always.
It is incredible to watch, I have to say.
Well, thank you, man. I mean, I don't have the same confidence in my writing. Like, I feel like my writing is good, but that's not the thing I like. Oh, I'm a brilliant writer, but I know I can perform.
Right.
And so I had full belief in that, and I had a brilliant director called Owen Lewis, who's worked with so many great comedians, and he worked with me, and another guy called Jeremy Lim, who's a brilliant writer and performer,
right,
who helped me a lot. And so then I put this show together. We did it in Edinburgh, and then within 3 days, the entire run had sold out.
Wow.
Which was incredible,
yeah.
Especially having gone to Edinburgh since and realised it isn't always like that. So, you know, and it was amazing. Did extra shows, did shows in bigger venues, and it was an incredible experience. And that led on to I did 2 UK tours. I went to America, I went to Russia with it, I went to Spain with it. I did a month in Toronto in an 800-seater venue.
So all that experience must have been fantastic.
It really was, but I made a decision at the end of the Canada run, which would have been 2015. So I'd done the show for 3 years, and I made a decision then of, you know, basically people were coming to me and saying, look, do you want to do, you know, the show was called The Only Way Is Down To.
Yeah.
And they were like, do you want to do The Only Way Is Game of Thrones?
Oh.
And the thing is I was like, well, you know, this has been a big success. Do you then transfer the same ideas into a new show? And it was completely possible thing to do, but I just thought, I'm never going to be able to be on shows as this guy that does a one-man Downton or a one-man Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
I'm never going to be able to be more than what I do live, so I had to find a way of being able to be me,
right,
as well as do my impressions, do my singing, do everything. But I had to find that, and that was like going back to school, because I went from playing an 800-seater venue and turning up to gigs and people being like, how many gigs have you done? And I'm like, but I don't know, really. I'm like, essentially 5, but
right,
also 400 in front of thousands of people.
That's fascinating, because you were like thrown into it, because there's a lot of comedians who I know who, what I love to do is watch them develop, and I've seen them in little tiny clubs play to about 10 people and to gain the experience that way. But if you had your show written and did that first and then went into the comedy clubs, that's fascinating.
And I remember, so Ian Sterling was one of my best mates.
Yeah.
We were friends at the time before I did my first gig. But this is my first gig after doing all the stuff I've talked about.
Yeah.
Because it's like a different chapter. It's like you've got musical theatre chapter, so I'm learning all the performance skills there. Then you've got this downturn chapter. And then you've got, right, I'm going to start gigging. And interestingly, even before I'd done that first gig, I had my own show on ITV2 called... Luke Kempner's impression of 2015.
Yeah, I remember
where I was given, like, you know, this show, and I had to sort of present it, and they were like, "Oh, just, you know, sort of make it your own." I was like, "I don't know what my own is." You know? where if I was doing The Only Way Is Downton on TV, fine, that would have been great, but it wasn't that. And I'm pleased with what the show became, but I just didn't have the experience that I then went right. And then I went into gigs, and actually, well, James Gill was, he did the warm-up for that show.
Yeah, he does a lot of warm-ups.
And we got on really well. He was so kind, and he actually, ABC was my second ever gig.
Wow.
So in 2016, that was my second ever gig.
Wow.
And I didn't know what I was. I'd written this little sort of story about Andy Murray trying to get a date, I think, and he was getting lots of advice from, you know, everyone from Louis Theroux was giving him advice, and you know, you can do this, and I think Alan Carr was probably in there giving him some advice, and Tom Daly, and probably Michael McIntyre. I probably did this sort of thing of them giving him advice, and I was trying to get away of me being in it as well. And I think I remember thinking, oh, I've got to have a line about my appearance, because everyone, you always go, I know what you're thinking, I look like this. And I think I said something like, I know what you're thinking, River Island's been sick on me. And I remember it sort of not getting much of a laugh. But I remember being on, I was on with Susie Ruffle and myself, and I can't remember who else was on, but it was just like, I just didn't know what I was doing, but I was very lucky to get gigs like ABC, because I was learning from brilliant people around me. So it was a new chapter.
It is an extraordinary room to play as well. It reminds me of going to the Fringe every week, the Edinburgh Fringe, because it's such a enclosed room, but the audience is so up for it, and that's obviously what James Gill can do very well. And he prepares the acts so they can go on. And I find it fascinating going there every week. I first remember you, as I say, from your Downton video. You are a man of many talents. Tell me about the subsequent tour, the Only Way Is Downton. I know you've touched on it before. Did it go right round Britain?
It was amazing. You know, I was everywhere from like St Austell in Cornwall to 50 people to, you know, 300 people in Manchester.
Wow.
You know, it was those sort of venues. And then it was amazing, because I would then bump into touring companies. Like, I remember doing it in Cardiff and bumping into the Wicked touring
company. Yeah.
And they were like, Wicked's going on upstairs in the big, and I'm like, I know, I'm old, you know. And it was, interestingly, the people from like Wicked or We Will Rock You, I think, was on at the same time, and they were like, it's amazing what you're doing, like, well done, you know, you've done this on your own, you've broken out in a way. And as much as I went from playing 2,000 seaters in musicals to playing everything from a 50 seater to a 300 seater, little art centres around the country, and I was learning all the time, but I think the thing is, I was learning all the time, but I was still performing basically a play I'd written. So it was brilliant and I loved every second of it. America was hard because I was on my own in America, and it was...
That must have been daunting.
it was daunting, and I was there for a month, and it was, you are very isolated. I mean, you know, yeah, we're feeling what isolation is like now, but yeah, like, you know, I felt very isolated, and I didn't enjoy the American tour as much. There were some bits where I had some family, and I liked that, and I played some like massive venues, which was just, wow, you know, I remember being in Connecticut in a 1,000-seater.
Wow.
And just, the Americans, they just love Downton, and we'd rewritten the show to work for America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so playing those venues was just incredible and amazing. But yeah, it almost feels like it just sort of was this kind of journey that I just kept sort of just bouncing along with.
Would you say then that to date, that's the best experience you've had of writing your own show and performing it and...
Do you know what? No, actually. Right. Like, I loved Downton and every second of it. I really did. But for me, like, I did my last tour before COVID, the House of Faces tour.
Yeah.
And I did it at Leicester Square Theatre. And, you know, it was, I think we'd sold about 300. And I had, you know, for me, that was sort of the end of that, this new chapter.
Right.
Because gone from, I'm not going to do dancing, I'm going to do Luke Kempner.
Yeah.
And I'm going to still do my impressions, still do my singing, still do everything I do, and be silly, fuck around. It's going to be carnage, but also a show I've done. And for me, it all came together, and that tour went really well. And that performance, I had my manager, you know, having moved to Avalon, which was a big move for me, and
yeah,
it just felt like everything was, it's sort of a rounded up, and we lost a bit of connection, I think.
We did a bit, just a bit, but we're all right.
Okay.
I think we're back.
I'm back.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, let's move on into more detail about the Edinburgh Fringe. I saw your show take a long, hard look at yourself in 2017. Yeah. Great title. And you probably hear me laughing midway back. I was crying with laughter at the impersonations. What was your first Edinburgh Fringe like?
Well, the thing is, you know, I sort of give myself two first Edinburghs, because I had the first Edinburgh with Downton,
right,
we talked about, and then the second.
Oh, has it gone again?
And again at a bigger venue, and then I had even gone out there and done a new sort of show, which was all about this fake story of me marrying Judi Dench, but she cheated on me with different people, and I ended up it was a sort of mad story, and but I really enjoyed it was great, and again a stepping stone, and the show went well, and I was really pleased with it. I sold well, and then the next show that you saw, Take a Long Hard Look at Yourself,
like, yeah,
that was the first time I'd done anything sort of about me,
right,
you know, talked about stuff that had happened in my life, and that was the first time I felt ready to even do that kind of material, and I mixed it with sketches and stuff like that, and it was great to do, and I feel like it was something I needed to tick off my list of something, talk about some stuff that meant something to me. In a serious way, I know I talked about my estranged father. I talked about, you know, my relationship with my, you know, other family members and things. And I learned from that show that what I like doing is being silly. And I feel like part of that show was a bit serious, fine to do, and I'm glad I did it. But I know now that if there's going to be anything serious in it, it's got to come by accident, because what I like doing is being stupid and silly, and anything could go wrong at any time, and it's okay. I can laugh.
That's what we love you for.
Exactly. That's what I like. That is me, you know, is just fucking around.
Yeah. What do you think makes a good impressionist and comedian?
Well, I think it's, you've just got to find your own thing. You know, like, what I don't like is when people, I think people, some people think impressionism is, you know, being, you know, is sort of a kind of sort of hack thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And can think of, and some impressionists might fit into that category. But I feel like I respect every impressionist because I think it's a skill, and I know how long it takes to work out a new impression, find out what's funny about it. It be rubbish, then it be good. You know, I remember working on Piers Morgan and never been able to get it, and then suddenly I found the voice, and then I did it. You know, then I've done it in front of now, and I've done it on Spitting Image, and it changes, and you find your things with it. But like, I know when it was rubbish, and it didn't sound like that at all. So, but what I've always prided myself on is that my jokes, they might not necessarily be sort of the same as another comedian, but my jokes will come out through what characters, and right, it'll be a comment on something. You know, if I'm doing,
you know, I want to do an impression of Christopher Biggins, and I will find a way of telling a joke, you know, a sort of, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but it would be a way of my, it might be my observation about Christopher Biggins, it might be my observation about the fact that Debenhams is closing. And, you know, you will find your observation.
And that is fantastic.
I will use it through him,
yeah,
or I'll use it through me and my opinion on it, and it will just, they are my jokes, but they're coming through in different ways, you know?
It's a really good way of expressing what you want to say through your characters.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I remember listening to a great interview with James Acaster,
yeah,
and it's sort of saying, he just got to a point where he was like, with his writing, of how he wanted to write it through this character. Now, the character's still James Acaster, and I would, you know, never want to sit here and analyse the greatest comedian of all time. But he inspired me, because I was like, I don't like writing just through myself. I like writing through these characters. And as much as I might have 100 characters, but you are finding ways to write through them, and sometimes it might be a joke I don't want to say, but I think Biggins saying it will be great, you know, Jeremy Kyle or whatever, yeah, you know, it, you're sort of giving it to someone else, but yet you're still performing.
That's brilliant. That's such a good answer. Describe the process, please, of creating an impression. What comes first with you? Is it the voice or the look or what?
Interesting question. I mean, for me, these days, it very much comes from what is inspiring me. Sometimes it's what I'm working on. Like, yeah, you know, I've done a lot of Love Island stuff recently, working on the show. And so, you know, I knew I had my Ian Sterling impression. That's because I've been friends with him for years. Then he became famous, and luckily I had. But then I've got to listen to every Islander. The same when I worked on Big Brother, it was every you know, housemate. And for me, my process goes from listening lots. I'm so lucky these days that I've got YouTube, I can just watch loads of videos. And then it's working out, I want to know where they're from originally.
Right.
Because someone like Kim Woodburn, you know, she's got this kind of voice, you know, she talks like that, Kim Woodburn, hello, lovely. And then you find out that she is from Liverpool originally. So, you don't like, but you don't make her like, you know, she don't talk like that. But you know that there are a few of those little sounds in there, so you need to just be careful, just to fit them in there, lovey. Don't stop it. Like, and then you're just sprinkling, it's like a little pie, you know, you just sprinkle that bit in there, and then, you know, if you've got,
you know, like I was doing a bit of Piers Morgan, and you find out that it's a little bit, you know, if you were during Kermit the Frog, you would be surprised to your mouth. That's where you would be. So, you know, that's sort of where Piers is. He's in
morphs
the back
into
of the
it.
And then, you know, that's a, even that sounds there, that's a bit lispy. So that's a sort of Piers. And then you've got the tune of what, the tune of what he says. And then you're writing jokes on top of that and going, okay, no, don't talk, Susanna, because I'm going to say something. I'm the most important person in the world. And you're
it's just a building process. And it's interesting because I remember John Kern said to me, and I'm taking this as a massive compliment, but he said to me, he's like, it's amazing what you do, because you're kind of 100 comedians. You're not just one. You're like having to keep...
That's the magic, yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, you're right, actually, John. It is that. But you're not finding one thing that works. I know, as me, that I can talk about being in Les Mis and pretend I'm very embarrassed about it, but then go on about it. I've got that. I know that I can pretend to be not arrogant, but actually be arrogant with a tongue in my cheek. I know I've got that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my stick, if you want to call it that. But then you're coming up with little sticks for every single character. So then you can perform little bits, and you're trying to give everyone so much within one, 20 minutes.
That is fascinating, because I'm such a big fan of people who can do what you do, impersonate celebrities. When I was at college in the 80s, people used to stop me in the street. I went to college in Stoke, and they used to stop me in the street because of my likeness then to Eddie Edwards, the ski jumper. I was his absolute double.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And the lecturers at the college used to stop the lectures and come back to me and say, you're not his brother, are you? because I didn't realize I had the voice. As a leaving present, I got he was opening a Radio Rentals and Eddie Edwards in Stoke, and I met him, and he looked at me and went, oh my god, he said, you could have made a mint. I said, and I thought, how do you get the voices and everything? And it really started from there. And then I went to see Rory Bremner, and I saw John Coleshaw, and then yourself. Yeah. And it was just, I'm fascinated at how it all worked.
It's amazing. You know, like I've worked with Rory Bremner a lot now, and I worked with Alistair McGowan.
Yeah, he's the other one.
On the show, and Alistair is very technical, and he taught me a lot in this sort of where, like that Piers Morgan voice, he taught me about just finding places where your voice can go.
Yeah.
You know, like, I know that I can make that noise.
I know that I can talk down here.
You know, I know that I can talk, you know, and that's where Downton worked really well, because I was doing all those different parts. Yeah. You know, that he was like,
oh, have you ever thought about, doing that, and then you go, oh, yeah, that's a different noise. That's a different noise.
And then when I was talking to him, I was doing my Jeremy Carl impression, and he was like, oh, that's very interesting. Where do you put it through your nose? I don't... I gave him that kind of, and it's weird because I see it like a little shape. Like,
yeah.
That's coming through there, isn't it? Obviously, the material has got to come over the top of that. But so he was very technical. But what Rory does brilliantly is he's just an absolute.
Oh, he's incredible.
His energy is. I think our energies are different, but I learned a lot from it. I was on a panel show with him, and we worked on a couple of things, and we stayed really good friends. And he's an inspiration. And
I saw him with Jan Ravens at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Oh, great! I didn't see that show
years ago, and it was fantastic. He was so up to date with the impersonation. She did an impersonation of Victoria Wood. Singing at the piano, and the whole crowd were just close to tears because it was so and so accurate again, both of them, and they worked brilliantly together.
We did the Raw Variety together. I think just when they're in the middle of that tour, myself,
right,
Jan, Rory, and Deborah Stevenson.
And
working with those guys, I think Rory's great in the fact that he sees me as the new sort of crop and is very encouraging of that and has been sort of, knows that I work differently to him. But what has been great about those guys is they're so professional and they work so hard. And showed them that I had that same ethic, that they took to that and have been very welcoming. And so I, you know, just hold them all very dearly. And yeah, so having the opportunity to work, you know, it's like, you know, is it Isaac Newton that said, you know, I see further from sitting on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah,
you know? And it,
yeah.
It is, you know, it is that. And comedy, I feel like, maybe not everyone says this, but I feel like you learn from the people around you all the time. You know, even today, like I work on Steph's Packed Lunch on Channel 4.
Yeah, yeah.
Richard Madeley was hosting the show today, and I learned some stuff from Richard Madeley. You know, you're just learning from him. You know, I supported Russell Kane on tour. I learned loads of stuff from Russell. Like, you know, you're just picking stuff up all the time and then putting it through your own views and your own ability.
The first impersonator I can ever remember on TV was Mike Yarwood.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And we're talking 70s now, and I often think, I know he's had problems with confidence and everything, but I often think he would make a fantastic Edinburgh Hour if he came back and decided to do it, because you hold him, I firmly believe you hold impersonators in such affection for what they can do.
Yeah,
and he may be of his time, but it, looking back and reminiscing, and you know, I just think it's a very special breed, and I'm so pleased to be talking to you about this. Do you have a favourite impersonation?
Do you know what, it really varies. Like I like it when I've got a new one,
yeah,
a new toy to play with, but. You know, I like camp characters. I come from the background of musical theatre. So, you know, get into B. I love doing Alan Carr because I know whatever I can say with him. But the thing is with him is obviously he's a comedian. So I don't, you know, I don't get as much delight doing comedians because I feel like they've done all the work for you. They make themselves funny. And then you're sort of, it's sort of a bit cheating, you know. You know. But then, you know, someone like Maggie Smith, because she's so this so much, and what, you know, why I look like this, why can't I play an 85-year-old woman, you know, I've been able, and I think what I really enjoy, and I feel like audiences don't, I never sat there going, but hang on, you got a beard, you ain't Maggie Smith. Because, like, of course I'm not. I don't look like nearly anyone I do, you know, but you're putting on that before, you know, in the same way that, you know, I don't look like poor Hollywood when I'm doing the poor Hollywood. What you're doing, man, is you're adding a handshake, you know, it's great at Richard, you're doing brilliant, not, you know, you've got a bit of a soggy bottom, but you're just creating stuff all the time.
And I
see the images in my head, you know, like, well, you know, I've done so much with Trump, of course, you know, he's been here for 4 years, it's been really great for me, not for everyone else. But, you know, I see, if I'm imagining a conversation between Donald Trump, or, you know, or Boris, is he, and he's talking, and I see that in that conversation happening in my head. And I hope, Richard, in the same way that, you know, when Donald's jumping in, that's what the audience is seeing as well. They're seeing two fantastic characters and brilliant impressionists. But they're sort of seeing that, as much as they're watching me, they're sort of seeing that conversation happen as well.
Is there an impersonation that has defied you? Has the one been challenging and you haven't been able to do for any reason? Or?
I find, you know, like, it's funny, the ones that I struggle with more are the ones that you're expected to be able to do. You know, it's like doing Arnold Schwarzenegger and I'm like, it's sort of like, it's just the kind of amalgamation of all the ones that people have done getting each other. So it's like stuff like that, or like, they're like, can you do a Morgan Freeman? I'm like, I can't get that low for him. Like, I just can't. Whereas those are the ones that people can do. So like, you can ask anyone below, you know, but you're looking for a Louis Theroux, I'm your guy.
How do you remember all your routines?
I don't. I'm sort of like, Ian's always like, mate, you're always rehearsing, mate. Why are you always practicing backstage? Just go on and do it. But like, I have to, like, I think the thing is, right, is I come from a theatre background, you know, yeah. Like, you rehearse for 6 to 8 weeks, then you perform the show for a year. You know, like, so my thing is, like, rehearse. Like, I'm doing it now in lockdown. There's no gigs, but I'm, like, I'm rehearsing new routines. So then when I've got a gig, they're ready to go. So I write them out word for word. I rehearse them until I know them inside out.
Yeah.
Because that's the best, that I can perform the best when I know something inside out. Because then that's when, if something happens, you can jump out of it because you know where you're going back to. You know, so like, I have bits written in that are more interacting with the audience because then I know that anything can happen.
Yeah.
I might have 3 pillars that I'm going to hit that gag. But other than that, let's see what happens. But most of my stuff is really tightly written. So I know that if anything extra happens, that's icing on the cake. But the bare bones of it is there and solid, you know.
Brilliant. Do you get nervous at all, and how do you cope with any nerves before you go on stage?
I do get nervous. I get more nervous at gigs than I do tour shows, and it's mainly because, well, you'll know from going to see lots of gigs, you know, like you can be anywhere. You can be like, you're right, you know, you're in the toilet and you're sat in a toilet, horrible toilet, and they're going, please welcome to the stage, Luke Hemner. And you're like, or you're at a festival stuck in the middle of some,
yeah.
I remember being stood at a festival, stood on thousands of wires, just being stood on these wires, James Acaster's on stage, he's absolutely crushing it, and then they're like, please welcome, and I'm like tripping over these wires, someone's going, oh, excuse me, do you know where the music temp one is? I'm like, no, I've not gone. So, like, then I'm nervous because I can't, I need, like, we're on a tour show or even in Edinburgh, really, like certainly in my later Edinburghs when you're at those nicer venues, you've got a place that you're ready, I can pace around. And then I tell you, mate, it's like as soon as I'm on stage, it changes completely.
It's
then
the
I'm,
best fit, yeah.
I'm ready to go then. And I, you know, that's, you know, it's unexplainable, that feeling, because it's just, it, you know, you're in the zone then.
It's fascinating you say that, because a story that come to mind was Matt Ford. He'd played London and he was going on tour. And I live and work in London, but my home city's Carlisle, and I go back as often as I can. And he was playing Carlisle, and he'd never played Carlisle before. And I took my best friends and his family, and it was about half full. And he bounded onto the stage, started doing his wonderful impersonations and not getting laughs, except for me in the front row, convulsing. I thought, what sort of audience is this? You know, just doesn't get the act. And afterwards, he tweeted me and he said, Rich, he said, that was weird. He said, thank God you were there.
Oh, no.
Because you never know what you're going to get. You know, that's the magic of it. But you have to play it to your strengths.
It's so true. And when you die at gigs, early doors, and even, you know, you're never far away from dying again. But like, hearing stories like that, it's like, for me, I'm like, what, Matt? That happens to Matt Ford? Like,
yeah,
what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then, but you'll hear everyone say it.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't believe, you know, Russell Kane will come off stage and go, oh man, that was a tough one out there. And you're like, what? You know, like.
It is. I find it wonderful to see when it goes well, but I really feel sorry for them when they're wanting to do really well and trying, and they, and to be fair to them, they just stay on stage and get through it. You have to keep going.
Well, that would be more interesting than, you know, than what's happened with coronavirus.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know, we've all had to learn either to do gigs online. You know, it's different. ABC is the best one, but there's others that aren't as good as that, and you're playing silence because there isn't anybody, of 1,000 people, but it's a music venue.
Yeah.
It's not made for people. So then it doesn't feel right. And it's like, there's so many ingredients that goes into a gig going well that you know, this is why, like, a lot of these corona, you know, gigs during coronavirus, there's part of you, I'm speaking for myself here, but I'm just like, oh, I just fucking can't wait till it's all over.
Because
just like, look, I want to still perform and you want to still get out there, but you're like, oh, it just doesn't feel like this is proper gigging, you know?
Yeah, it is. It is very true. I was going to ask you, do you find online gigs different to live gigs?
Well, I've pivoted a bit with it because online gigs now, not here because I'm in a hotel room, but I've now got a green screen. I've got a little deck so I can push little buttons and I can, you've seen the gigs, you know, and yeah, I can be like, you know, I can be Donald Trump in a prison. I can be David Attenborough in the Sahara Desert and I can be Joe Wicks in his front room. And like, for me, that works better than, well, not even works better, but like, I have enjoyed doing that style of it. I wouldn't be able to do that on stage because I haven't got green screen and I can't do mad costume changes. It's not really been my thing, but online, that's what I've enjoyed doing and that's how I've made it work for me, playing music cues, and it's just felt like a different sort of gig and I think I've found my place with it now.
Yeah, I think you can't beat live, certainly, but I think I always say to folk, it's much better than not to have the online thing.
They have been brilliant, like, you know, yeah. Like, you know, you're seeing comedians doing their thing in different styles, yeah. And it does work. It's not ideal, but as you say, it's better than not.
Yeah, and, it is. Yeah. Who are your favourite comedians, past or present? Do you have any of them, or do you have?
Oh yeah, like, I mean, you know, the first comedian I ever came across was Alan Davis,
right?
When I was really young, and I remember seeing his first video, and he was swearing a lot, and I loved it because I must have been 12 or something, and I was like, oh my god, this guy's saying fucking great, and he supports Arsenal. So I remember seeing that, and then I remember his second show as well, which I bought on video. Where I got it from, but anyway, I got that, and Urban Trauma was that show. Oh,
brilliant. Yeah.
Oh my god, I still, you know, I know his first story talks about going away to New Zealand and how they don't have bowels, and he talks about the Sydney Olympics, and oh god, like, I love that show.
He
so
is
much
brilliant.
And, like, so he was the first one. Actually, I gigged with him a couple of years ago, and it was like really, and we got a train all the way back to North London from what's it called? Happy Mondays gig, and it was amazing. You know, like, I didn't completely fangirl over him, but I just, you know, again, like, his set was incredible. He was just trying out a set for the Royal Variety, and it was amazing.
Brilliant.
So, you know, I Alan Davis, you know, was someone that I really got brought up on, and then interestingly, Russell Kane, really, because I remember seeing Russell do his set. I saw him do a set at the Comedy Store when I was about 20.
Yeah.
And was like, oh my god, and he was talking a lot about his dad, and I remember going like, oh my god, like, I've got the same life as this guy. you know, now I know Russell really well. And I'm like, we haven't got the same lives, but like, I just, it's inspiring, you know, seeing someone that sort of, just, I don't know, like, so he inspired me a lot. And then, you know, Billy Connolly, I love his sort of style. Alistair McGowan's shows, you know, his show Football Back Chat was one I used to know off by heart, and where he would speak over existing footage and do all the voices. You know, all of those older guys, and then, like, you know, sort of present, you know, those guys are still present, but present, you know, I love Bo Burnham.
Yeah.
I love James Acaster. I love Adam Sandler's.
He's brilliant.
Adam Sandler's latest special, just, like, again, really inspiring. Just seeing just some silly shit on stage.
Yeah.
So, I'm, you know, the trouble is with that question, when I answer it. It's just everyone inspires me. You know, like, I see so many brilliant people, so lucky to get to be on stage with them. You know, it's so loads of people.
I first saw Alan Davis years ago when he was first starting out.
Really?
And he did an hour, and the room was next door to a pub, to the bar. And he said to the audience, he said, if anybody wants to go and have a drink, wants to go and get a drink, I'll still be on stage if you come back in. And the whole audience went to the bar, leaving him on his own, chatting to four walls. And they came back and he still carried on. It was a sign of a truly great comic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Brilliant.
He was superb. Like me, do you go to many comedy gigs as a member of the audience?
I do when I'm in Edinburgh. Yeah. I'll go and see two shows a day because I just feel like you're so lucky to be up there.
Yeah.
But do I go to many gigs in London? Not as many now because you're gigging or you're doing, you're working something else.
Yeah.
But, you know, like when I started out doing, you know, the sort of the chapter post Downton, that's how I started out. Like, you know, I lived in Crouch End, so I'd go to the King's Head all the time. And then I'd just start going to see little gigs I could find, like the Camden Head, Angel Comedy. Just going to those little gigs.
Been to them all.
I mean, what I've not done really is ventured, you know, up north and stuff. I've not done, you know, the sort of Manchester scene, Liverpool scene. Yeah. I've not really done that scene.
No.
Luckily, because I've been working, but it feels like it's a rite of passage that I still haven't.
It's definitely worth doing. Certainly Manchester and Liverpool. I went to the Frog and Bucket for the first time last year, and it was fantastic. Really good comedy room.
Oh, God, yeah. And so many great people have come from those places.
Yeah. Well, that's where Peter Kay started. My annual holiday is the Edinburgh Fringe. I'm very lucky. I go up there for a week and I see about 50 shows. I need a holiday when I come back.
Amazing stuff. But it's a magic place. And
it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Let's just hope it can come back.
I'm sure it'll be back in some shape or form.
Just
one more thing, my friend. Have you got anything else to say? Anything to any online gigs or anything? I know you do Twitch.
I stream on Twitch.
Fantastic.
Oh well, there's my Twitch channel, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah,
where I mainly stream me playing cricket.
It's brilliant, and you do all the voices as well. It's great.
That's good fun, and we've created a really lovely little community there. You know, people who. And they'll all watch this because they're very supportive. But they are a great, you know, in this period of time where we've all found isolation and had to work out what our lives are, you know, and to have created that community of people who, I don't know any of them personally, but we have a little Discord where we all chat about cricket and football and politics or whatever, and as well as my stream, when we'll talk about it on stream, and they're a group of people that would never have come together if it wasn't for Twitch.
And
I get lots of lovely messages of people saying, you know, like, been really down this year and this community has been really helpful, or I work from home now but I don't see anybody and this is my connection with people. And I feel like it's funny something to have stumbled across that, and it's a small community, but it's something that I think is very important.
Oh, it's brilliant. It really is. Yeah.
So it's been great, you know, and as far as that, you know, just to say a big thank you to you and a thank you to James Gill and the ABC community as well, because that's its own community. And I think it's brilliant that it's managed to flourish still with online gigs. Because it really is it's a magical place and atmosphere and group of people, you know.
Well, you're very kind, and I just want to say thank you so much for your time, because I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. You're one of my favourite impersonators, and I wish you every success, my friend.
Thank you so much, Richard. Absolute pleasure.
Thank you. All the best to you. Thank you.